Welcome back to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by CalTon20.com, CoreSports.com, and of course our Challenged Athletes Foundation. And you can check out any of our interviews up on iTunes at Babbittville Radio. Our next guest, one of our favorite guys, he's former motocross champion, went over to Ironman, had three classic races with Carlos Malaita in 2000, came away with the Ironman World Championship title in the hand cycle division. Mr. David Bailey joins us. David, how the heck are you?
Doing good, Bob. It's good to be back. I took a little break for a while doing other things, but I was all leveled out now and kind of got an eye on doing a little bit more racing.
I love it. Love having you back racing. So speaking of racing, I mean, you started, riding your bike at 3 years old, and you were racing 60cc Yamaha at what age? 10 years old or something?
Yeah, about 10. I didn't really have that much of a desire to ride motorcycles, really. I mean, the grown-ups, you know, were riding out in the hills in Dana Point, and I was so happy on my bicycle and rather intimidated by the motorcycle stuff because, you know, back then, you know, the mid to late 60s, those things were, it wasn't really like a motorcycle, it was like a car.
Yeah, they were big, so, right? They were gigantic.
You know, to be a kid and get on one of those was like, no thanks. So I just kept riding my bike around, and then through my parents, you know, and this separation and stuff, my mom remarried to Gary Bailey, who was a pioneer of American motocross and nicknamed the professor. He went on to teach and still teaches. And so, you know, I landed in a good spot in terms of, you know, being a rider, to have that kind of instruction right off the bat. So jumped on a 60 at age 10, and it just felt like, I think I was, you know, a natural, I guess, and kept growing from there.
And that was, so you moved from Dana Point back to Virginia?
Actually, no, I moved to Winnebago.
You moved to Winnebago? You
guys? Yeah, that was our address. You know, we had a 25-foot Winnebago and a 25-foot trailer. That was the garage we hauled around. And my mom would book schools at different tracks, you know, mostly back east. And my dad would, you know, and I would show up and set up the circus, the tents, the bikes, get everything all dialed. And he'd have classes with, you know, anywhere from 40 to 60 and sometimes up to 100 guys. And then he started splitting it in 2 days and 4 days. So we traveled around from about 1970, 71 until 75 with no home. Driving around.
So basically you were helping out and learning and teaching at the same time?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, Gary trusted me to understand the flow of things and so that he could be effective with the teaching. He knew I could keep the riders, you know, sort of somewhat organized and separated so that as they ran through sections, you know, there'd be enough of a space and not just a big cluster. And, you know, then I get to ride in the evenings with him and imagine being in the dugout and you don't get to play.
Right.
If you really love it and want to play, you're going to pay attention. So I did. I really learned a lot and more so from the riders that I noticed weren't listening or weren't applying things, because the people that are really good, it's sometimes real subtle and it's hard to pick up on why. They're just fast. But the guys that don't do it right, you know, it's very obvious. And so when it was my turn to be at bat, you know, I knew what to do.
So when did you feel like, wow, I could be good at this?
Right around like 15 years old.
Yeah.
It, you know, up until there, I liked it and it felt like I was going somewhere with it. But from the outside looking in and reflecting back on it myself, there wasn't much there. But around 15, the results started to show and others started to approach me and go, man, you know, and they started calling out certain elements of my style that like were surprising to me, like, really? And I started to gain a little confidence. And then at age 16, I won the amateur national championship back in Atlanta on a Spanish motorcycle that was almost obsolete by then, a Boltaco.
Boltaco, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah. And then Team Green with Kawasaki was a brand new deal, and they were out of Atlanta. So So one of the guys that was at Bultaco once they closed the doors, he went down to Team Green and was gracious enough, a fellow named Dave Jordan, and brought me in. And I won a title later that year of a support class thing and for them. And a couple of years later was picked up by Honda in 1982. The five-time world champion, Roger DeCoster, who's still a team manager today and very successful, he gave me the call and he saw something. And that was like the greatest vote of confidence you could ever get. You know, it's like Michael Jordan calling me going, I see potential in you, you know? And so I just grew leaps and bounds from there.
So what's interesting is when we think of motocross now, we think of stadiums, we think of the Coliseum and Anaheim, and you think of Supercross. But a lot of your, you know, when you look back at your career, you had a lot of outdoor wins. When did the Supercross really start to take hold?
Probably very late 70s, early 80s, right in there, like a 3 or 4 year pocket, you know, 78, 79, 80, 81, right in there. My first Supercross experience ever as a racer was in Atlanta. A lot of things, realizing that now. That was my first race. And when I went and looked at which heat race I was going to be in, they only take four out of it, 20 riders on the line, four riders make the main. And even my stepdad Gary, he looked at the lineup for my heat, and it was just, you know, like eight guys, and I probably had their jerseys and autographs, you know. And so he just looked at me and I was like, oh well, you know, hey, just go out there and have some fun.
Yeah.
And I got the whole shot and was leading the race and ended up transferring directly to the main, and I did horrible in the main, but that got me feeling like, well, you know, I got a taste at the front.
Sure.
And really started to enjoy it. So my success came in 83, perhaps a year sooner than I was anticipating or planning in my rise to the, you know, to the front of the pack. And so that's when it really kicked off for me. But Supercross as a sport, Gary was laying out the Supercross races, courses at Daytona in the tri-oval between pit road and the front straightaway. And simultaneously, this is back in 74, there was the LA Coliseum Super Bowl of Motocross. It wasn't even Supercross yet. So I watched it from the very, very beginning turn into a sport, and, you know, from the 74, and then, you know, by 9 years later, I was the champion of it. So I was really privileged to have that kind of a run.
And what's amazing is, you know, when you're outdoors, yeah, there's spectators out there, and I'm sure there's good crowds. But when you're inside, you know, somewhere like Anaheim Stadium, and there's 70,000 people going nuts, I mean, could you tune them out, or were you fueled by the crowd?
I was fueled by it a little bit, nervous by it, and certainly aware. You know, I mean, there were times for sure where I tuned it out, and you just have to, you know. But there are other times where it's exciting as a rider. You know, outdoor, there's pockets of fans, and you know the hill people they have in Unadilla, in New York, and the back section in Pennsylvania where it smells a little funny. They might be smoking some stuff and, you know, things like that. So you get that kind of Woodstockish type deal outdoors at times, but where indoor, it's just like a football or you know, any other major sport where it's a consistent, familiar roar, noise, and cheer. And you know, that was really cool, but it's also extremely intimidating, you know, because you're not used to stuff like that, and you go and you're surrounded by that sound. So to be down on the floor, it's very different than being up in the crowd where the sound is coming from certain areas. When you're on the floor, it's coming from everywhere, and you can feel it. Pretty neat.
So when I look back at that era with, you know, Jeff Ward and Ricky Johnson and Johnny O'Mara and Brock Glover and David Bailey, it was sort of a really cool era in the sport. Even if you were a teammate with somebody, it's like one of those things where it's an individual sport, and at the same time you're part of a Honda team or whatever. Could you be buddies with guys that you had to basically try to beat in something like a Supercross?
Oh yeah, you could be. But you know, there was, as soon as it started getting to where it's just you and your teammate that are going for the championship, which, you know, I was watching the last race of the National Championship Series this year that ended in Utah, and it was two of Roger DeCoster's, who I just mentioned being the team manager, two of his riders going against each other. And I just watched F1 this morning, and you got the Mercedes guys going against each other. So although you can cooperate and learn from each other and elevate each other, there does become that separation of, I want this.
Sure.
That guy, you know, I want it. And so there's a little bit of gamesmanship that goes on, and sometimes tempers, you know. I mean, when I was at Honda with Johnny O'Meara, we started really enjoying training and triathlon. He got me into running, and I might have got him a little bit into cycling. And then we both noticed Ironman, and so we were established at Honda. And then DeCoster and some of the other management decided, you know, these guys are getting too comfortable, and we want to keep our run going. And this, so they hired Rick Johnson.
Right.
And that was just like, you know, bull in a china shop kind of a deal. They knew he wasn't there to make friends. And so it lifted the intensity on the team. And that year we were first, second, and third, Rick and I and Johnny in whatever order, the whole year. And then went on to the Team USA, won with a perfect score, just an epic day for the United States. So, the teams are, you know, you can learn a lot from each other, which was always neat, to keep each other on our toes through testing. And then when it gets down to a championship chase and first place gets, you know, $500,000 for winning, and second place just gets, you know, $2,000.
A bagel and a T-shirt.
That's going to ruffle things up a little bit. And that certainly happened to the point where Honda had to restructure our contracts and give somebody some kind of a bonus for second, so that we wouldn't just ruin it, you know.
Kill each other. Well, it's funny. I was just actually watching a little earlier. I went online, was watching the 86 Supercross at Anaheim Stadium that kicked off the season, and it was you and Ricky Johnson. And I don't know how many times you guys passed each other, but it was really fun to watch, because there was points where the announcer's going, oh, and Ricky looked really comfortable. And he's like, oh, my God, Bailey just jumped over him. And it was, yeah, where you jumped over him to the inside. And I was like, wow. I mean, did you get a – obviously, you guys raced a lot. But do you get a sense when you're in a classic race like that, that it is a classic as you're involved in it?
Yes. Actually, this guy from Europe was – he just emailed me. He was making a replica bike from that year for Rick and myself, and he was asking me about their race, and I was telling him that in the beginning, Rick Johnson got ahead and was riding well, and I was maybe sixth or something, and probably to the fans for the first four or five laps, it looked like, well, you know, should we stay and watch the end, or maybe try to beat the traffic? You know, it was one of those.
Yeah.
And then Rick started to make a few mistakes, and he came up on a lap rider who he had a collision with on the first lap, and in anticipating what that guy might do to kind of mess with him and hold him up, he started making mistakes and losing time, and I got into second by then and was really starting to find my groove. So I was closing the gap, and I could feel what back then, you know, was the old Anaheim Stadium, and it was 70,000 strong, and I could sense the anticipation building and building, and I'm like, wow, this is going to be good, but I don't think the crowd knows that I've already figured I'm going to win this thing, and it's just going to be over as soon as I pass him. But what happened, Rick figured, all right, he's catching me, and when he does, then we'll fight. I'm going to quit fighting myself and just let him get here, and then we'll go at it. And he passed me right back, and
yeah.
Then what took place afterwards was just back and forth and back and forth. To where I'm like, man, this is going to be something we'll be talking about for years, and don't screw this up. You know, it's just what I kept telling myself, just stay in it, and eventually he was worn out, and I took the win.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to be in a classic race, but it's always better to be talking about it as the guy who won the classic race.
Yeah. You know, I've many times shared with Rick, you know, we're friends, and you know, hey, it doesn't matter that much that whether, you know, who won. It was just a great battle to be a part of, and they're still talking about it. He's like, yeah, that's because you won.
Exactly.
That's I don't know how it feels for him, but
that's true.
Probably not as good as it does for me, you know. But he's the reason, and I've said that many times, you know, in the motocross world, that it was his fight, don't give up attitude that made that a great race. Because in my mind, I was catching him quick and figured, well, you know, I might have to put up with him for a few laps and figure out a way around. We had talked just prior to the start, it's probably going to come down to us, so let's not, you know, do anything stupid, because we had a history of that.
Of knocking each other out?
Oh, on purpose, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So we kind of just went, let's knock it off. And then he came, that was when he was still at Yamaha. He came to Honda, and right before the start of that race in the tunnel, you know, we're just like, yeah, let's be smart. It's the first race of the year, and not start anything. And when I passed him, he passed me right back. That was clean. But then he took me way wide, and I'm like, well, I guess I would have done that. And I passed him back, and then each pass he made on me was just a little bit more intense, a little bit more intimidating, to where I started feeling like, what about the talk we had, you know? This is starting to feel like... So I can imagine what, you know, DeCosta and our management was thinking, because it was looking like we could take each other out.
Right, you know? And then somebody else from another team wins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was that's what made it great. He was a fighter, and what I thought was going to be an easy win for me, the way I was catching him, I just had, like, I got it in my head. And as soon as he passed me back, he and his fighting ability completely erased that confidence. And then the crowd was stoked, and I started feeling like, well, maybe I don't have it. And it was great, you know. The crowd got so loud that it was hard to hear our bikes, and we could judge what was going on behind us based on the crowd's reaction. You know, if that guy was taking a different line or had a spot where he was gaining time, the crowd would let us know, and that was pretty neat to be a part of.
When you look back, was that your greatest race?
Well, no, that's what I was talking about Phil in Europe about. It just, for me, it was, I thought it would be an easy win. Then when Rick got me, then it was like, okay, don't mess it up. Just probably like Mark felt in Hawaii in 89, like, okay, just stay with Dave. Just stay there, you know, get to the point where you can try to do something in the end. And so that's what I was trying to do with Rick. And so for me, it wasn't probably quite as exciting as it was for the fans. And certainly one of the greatest races to have won, you know, and looking at great races and all that. But no, other races, had to dig way deeper, and it actually went, you know, beyond my limits and stuff. But that moment you said where I jumped over Rick, I pulled the trigger there and did something that was a total risk. It worked out.
Yeah, because it's funny.
Like, what was that about? And I'm like, I don't know. Just had a run and went for it.
It was so funny because I'm watching and he's sort of on the out. He's sort of like on the inside a little bit. You line out, and then all of a sudden you like jump over him and land in front of him. And I'm like, I wish we could have had a photo or a face of a camera on his face at that moment when you basically jumped from second place in the lead and landed right in front of him.
It made him mad for sure. I don't know if mad's the right word, but it made him go, hey, you know, and I knew I had it by inches or an inch, but he didn't know that and viewed it as like how I was viewing his passes on me. And if just the very next turn or the very next turn after that, he went and ran into me twice. Like, hey, knock it off. But, you know, I was just letting him know, if you want to be intimidating, you know, so can I.
Exactly.
So it was a good fight for sure.
Love it. And so in 86, you had actually gone over to watch the Ironman. Was it on your honeymoon that you went over to watch the Ironman? And at that point, because you, like you said, you guys were training almost as triathletes, swim, bike, and run. Did that help you as a motocross guy?
Yeah, I think it helped a lot because I was getting into that stage where I, you know, in 82, I was starting to do really well. I won some races. In 83, I won everything.
Yeah.
In 84, I moved up a class from the 250cc bike, the middle class bike that we raced in Supercross, up to the 500cc bike outdoor. And I won again in that class, and I won the overall points for the year. So I had 2 years of really good, and 85 was pretty good. And then, you know, I started to get maybe a little bit...
complacent?
Too complacent, and I needed a little something. And so I felt like, you know, where's that going to come from? And I was, you know, watching TV, and ABC Wild World of Sports back then was covering the Ironman, and I just thought, man, that is... I was more intrigued with that than what my own sport.
Right.
And so I started training. I did a triathlon in South Carolina and met a couple guys and that were into it and had done Hawaii. And so that reinvigorated my whole program, and almost to the point where, you know, a couple of times my mechanic at Honda was like, hey, are you going to be a triathlete or a motocrosser? You know, get some priorities straight here. You know, I'm spending long hours to get this bike ready, and you're over there running around and, you know,
yeah,
running shorts and stuff. And where's your focus? So exactly. I had to realign that, and I had a little bit of a off year in 85 because I got so into triathlon and running and cycling that I was perhaps overtrained, and my focus wasn't where it belonged. And so in 86, I got that iron back out, and my fitness is what helped me beat Rick in that race we were just talking about. He was just out of gas, and I had extra in the tank. So, yeah, I loved my motocross career, and it took me a season to figure out how to splice in the kind of training that I started to really grow to love. And, you know, that served me well, you know, when I got hurt, I think, later, because I had such good fitness. I was able to, you know, limit some of the damage. Sure. And have a little bit more momentum when I needed it.
So in 87, when you crashed, and it goes like in January, did you know when you hit the ground that you were paralyzed, or did you not know until you got to the hospital?
I didn't have any idea what was going on. It was a funky morning, kind of overcast. I didn't really want to do the race, and I thought, well, you know, I said I was gone. It was just a warm-up event up near Fresno before the Anaheim 86, you know, repeat in 1987.
Yeah.
And I was going in feeling really strong, really confident, riding right on the edge. And I took that kind of attitude to this warm-up race. And so I tried to jump something that was, you know, according to other people, like, what were we thinking? And while I was thinking, I could do anything.
Of course.
And, you know, obviously that wasn't the case. So when I hit the ground, I couldn't clear this double jump and just nosed it and got drilled by the bike or somehow I, you know, broke my back. But I was knocked out instantly. And Jim Feltz, actually, Feltz Bikes, he was the first one to me and was, you know, I remember hearing his voice was the first thing when I came to. Just, you okay, buddy? And I just said to him, boy, you know, I could tell right then as I was coming to, that's always weird anyway, but I didn't feel right. It was just a weird, deep, like, boy, I'm not racing today.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first thing that came to mind. Second was, man, I might miss Anaheim. And then everyone started gathering around, and I just was numb, couldn't feel anything. And I thought, well, is that because... I got all these blankets on me, you know, because it was a chilly morning. And I just kept asking questions like, "What? Why can't I feel this?" You know, and I'm tapping on my stomach and stuff. And the guys in the ambulance, I know this now, years later, they were fans of, and they knew me. And they understood what was going on and that there was a potential back injury, perhaps paralysis. And by my questions, I remember now, thinking back to those guys just looking at each other like, oh boy, you know, this is devastating. And wait till he gets a load of this and his wife. And it was a blow to them. You know, one of these guys that went on to be an announcer, I still know him, a fellow named Larry Nastin, and he said, man, that just altered his life a little bit. It just was a blow. It was a blow to the sport.
Oh, sure.
And my family, you know, the news was being told to them before me. You know, I was in intensive care and came to, and they came with a feed tube, and the whole nightmare began, you know, and they knew the news, and I was still like, well, you know, I'll get better soon. This will go away, and when do I get to go home? That was the attitude I had at first.
And the hard part about that is you're thinking, hey, I'll be in the hospital for a while, then I'll get out, and I'll rehab, and I'll come back. And I know you mentioned that Jim Knob was real instrumental in getting you back to the point of understanding, okay, don't worry about what might happen later. Worry about what you can deal with now.
Right. Yeah, as I said earlier, we traveled around in Winnebago. When we finally settled, it was in Virginia, and that's where I ended up having a couple hundred acres and tracks, and it was the whole deal. You know, perfect setup.
Right.
But when I was racing, you know, because there was nothing to do there otherwise. It was pretty out in the boonies. And so being injured and staring at all my tracks, my mountain bike, my road bike, my motorcycle, my jet skis, the running trails, all that, it was just torture. And, you know, Gina was, you know, we'd been married 3 months, and I got hurt, and she hung in there. And one day I just said, you know, I met her out here in Carlsbad the first time, and I grew up out here, and I thought one night I just said, "Do you want to move? Just change it. Just move to California." And she started packing like right then, you know. So we actually packed everything up, and I went to the Ironman in '89.
Oh, so you were there for Iron War?
Yep, blew up the bridge behind me, and there was a big, you know, semi with our life headed across the United States while we were in Kona watching that battle. And when I came home from that, I stayed at what was then P. Soup Anderson's down there in Carlsbad.
Yep.
Until we found a place for that semi to park and unload. And you know, it was good to get back out here. That really quickly led to meeting Jim Knob. And up till then, I was just lost, you know. I didn't know what to focus on and what to do. None of it, into the suggestions, sounded fun. And the things that I was trying to do, thinking, well, maybe tomorrow I'll be able to wiggle a toe or feel something, that wasn't happening. So I was pretty depressed and dragging Gina through things. And, you know, just before meeting Knob, I'd seen this movie with Joe versus the Volcano or something, and there was a moment in there where Tom Hanks, he thinks he's going to die sooner than, you know, he was told. And he's just, all of a sudden, just looked up at the sky and was just thankful for his life, but sorry at the same time that he'd kind of wasted it. And that really sunk into me. I was so in need of a message. And that message was, to me, it was like, man, if you knew how much time you had, you know, what would you be doing? And I was just wasting it, griping about things. And Knob got a hold of me when I was just really, you know, ready for some instruction. And although it was abrasive from him, it was the tough love I needed. And that got me my athletic career fired back up, which was all I knew. And it kind of put my feet back on the ground, so to speak, and I got some momentum again.
Well, what's great about Jim, a former Olympic trials pole vaulter, who was injured in a motorcycle accident as well and was paralyzed, but he was I had seen him at rehab centers and seen him where doctors had told the people in the rehab center, hey, they had told people what they can't do, and Knob would roll up in his Rambler convertible and grab his chair out of the back and hop in there and then roll in and say, listen, the doctor's told you what you can't do. I'm here to tell you what you can do. And just changed people's attitude from you know, worrying about what they, you know, hey, I've got to get the special van, I've got to get this, I've got to get that too. Let's just go to lunch. Let's just figure something out.
Yeah. But for when I met him, he was already parked, and I saw that Rambler with his race chair and another one for a young kid, Eric Neitzel. Both those chairs were hanging out of the back. The ones I'd seen up till then were four-wheelers with bungee cord steering and not interesting to me.
No.
Like a birdcage.
Yeah.
So, you know, after coming off of, you know, an F1 bike built by Honda, you know, just for me, special. That wasn't interesting. But I saw Jim's chairs hanging out the back of that Rambler. I didn't know him yet. I was going inside to meet him, all nervous. And he had been a three-time winner at that point of the Boston Marathon. And that chair, I was like, wait, that's a cool-looking chair.
Yeah.
You know, it has a three-wheeler and a front brake and has a big, cool-looking extrusion, you know, tube. And so as soon as I met Jim, he just looked at me like, what kind of chair is that? Why in such a big chair? He called it the barge, you know. And I'm like, we just met, man. You're already on my case, kind of. And I remember having the attitude like, well, I'm not going to be in this chair very long. You know, I'm probably going to get better. And he didn't roll his eyes, but, you know, thinking back, he probably was on the inside.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, at that point in time, although I was ready for something, I still had some pride and hope, you know, and wishful thinking that this was all going to change. And that's what I was focused on, plus how hard it was. You know, like, man, I used to be able to do this. Now it's like a hassle, and plus I got to do this and that. And I was baffled by why that didn't seem to affect him. And he was baffled why I couldn't just move on and realize that, you know, why walk when you can fly?
Yeah, that line. Why
what?
Walk when you can fly?
What are you talking about?
I know.
You know.
I know. That was.
But I've learned.
Yeah.
You know, and it took a long time. I'm a little stubborn, and I'll take instruction. But my pride, you know, at that time and still times gets a little bit in the way. And Jim just kept, you know, stripping the layers back until it got to the, you know, what are you going to do, Bailey? You know. You gonna walk tomorrow, or are you gonna just do the best you can with what you got? I'm not saying you'll never walk. I don't know, but I do know this: your wife's having to carry all your stuff around, and you got a, you know, brand new boy, and you know, get yourself together. You're focused on the wrong things, and so he invited me down to Cabo in 1990. Just after we'd met, and I think Gina enjoyed that trip perhaps more than I did early on, because she's like, woo, we're in Cabo and getting a tan, and Jim was teaching me how to do stuff that I didn't pay attention to in rehab. So I went home and was just, I didn't know how to transfer from here to there and do stuff. I needed, you know, spotters and help and people carrying me. And Jim goes, no, get in this van. It's a taxi, and I'm like trying to wait for a car or something easier. He's like, you can do it. And he'd show me and then teach me how to do it. And that was the same with a fishing boat during that trip, a jet ski, in and out of the pool, in and out of the bathtub. I came home from that trip full of confidence and chucked some of the paraphernalia I'd acquired, thinking I needed it, including a van with a lift in the side. And for my particular injury level, I didn't need that. Now, Jim would already be in his convertible waiting, and I'm trying to get the lift to go up and shut the door and transfer to the driver's seat. He says, come on, let's go. So I streamlined my life and started racing, and I did my first ever 10K right down in Fiesta Island against that kid, Eric Neitzel, and was just hooked right away.
Well, and then you go off and you win the Disney World Marathon. Then you know, have a couple of trips to Boston with Knob. And he wins his fourth and fifth. And then things sort of go full circle. You went to Kona to watch the Ironman in 86, and now all of a sudden you're thinking triathlon. And you end up coming to Kona for the first time in 98. But leading into 98, you had to go to Lubbock to validate and get there. And really, in 98, there'd only been, at that point, John McClain was the first guy to go under all the cutoff times in 97. So it's not like there'd been a lot of success stories with wheelers at the Ironman. So when you came back and after winning in Lubbock in 98, and you had a guy named Carlos Maleda who was there, who really was not a factor when you raced him in racing chairs and was not a factor in Lubbock. But when you went to Kona, all of a sudden that guy was a factor.
Yeah, he was. I was aware of him. You know, he's a real humble, quiet, handsome, real tan, you know, guy, and looked fit. And I saw him the morning of Lubbock. You know, it's dark, and you know, I think we're airing tires together or something. I remember thinking, yeah, he's going to be in there, but I think I got him. You know, I think I can do this. I've been paying attention to it way live into this clear back in the early 80s. You know, maybe he just became interested. And the kind of bike that he was on at the time wasn't quite as up to par, I think, with what I had. Even he would admit that. So I won. I beat him. He caught me. I saw a glimpse of, man, this guy's stronger than I thought. But I was able to get back away from him. I won by 10 or minutes or something. And not a lot, but enough for me to feel like I was on the right track. Well, he showed up in Kona with the same bike I had. Only it was black.
Yeah.
You know, he was the Dale Earnhardt, you know, the intimidator. And being a Navy SEAL and all, he was just tougher. He was just up to the task, and perhaps being beat in Lubbock motivated him to just rearrange his training and do more. And I kept doing about the same. And he smoked me in Kona. I was really surprised by how strong he was there. Even if I would have had a good day, I wouldn't have beat him. I think all the interest that I had in triathlon going back to the early 80s, he was on the fast track to like really sinking his teeth into the Ironman experience, and made a lot of headway between June in Lubbock to October in Kona, and it showed.
Well, and what was cool about it is Carlos went 10:55 that day, which, you know, remember a year before people were wondering if a wheeler could make all the cutoff times. At 10:55 would have won the able-bodied race back in the first 2 years of the Ironman. So all of a sudden, the you were leveling a playing field, and getting through the cutoff times was less an issue rather than the race itself. So when you started training for the following year, I'm sure Carlos was on your mind.
Oh yeah, he was on my mind all the time. You know, I thought about him. I was obsessed a little bit, I have to admit. You know, I came home already planning my training. Like, I'll take a little time off and let the sting maybe go away, or to some degree, to where I can start to focus on what I need to do to come back in 99 and get the result that I thought I was going to get. Actually, almost expected it.
Sure.
And in 99, I felt great. I swam, I don't know, 113 or something. Did pretty good. I came out of the water ahead of them. And I caught Animal, Randy Cadell, out somewhere by the 88-mile marker on the way up to Kauai High, and was having a great day. And then some physical stuff started creeping up, other types of issues related to our injury, and I just came apart on the way to the turnaround at Javi, and Carlos went by me. And I had I'm pretty friendly and talk to people, and
sure,
even now, you know, I can go on and on. And tell, and when Carlos went by me, I wanted to go, hey, you know, what do I do if this is happening? And he just ignored me. He went by me with a look on his face like it was, I still remember it. It was really like, wow, this guy's a competitor. I'm going to give a crap if I die right here. You know, that's tough for me.
Exactly. And it'll make it easier for him.
It was left a mark.
That's,
you know,
a little eye-opener, though, right? Because all of a sudden it's like, okay, this is a race. We're competitive here.
Yeah, so he got me again there, and I felt like, man, in 98 he should have won. And in 99 I'm just like, maybe I could have, but I don't know. This guy's pretty fierce. And in 2000 I just ramped it up, and I didn't focus. He was faster than me. He could get up a hill quicker. He had a little bit more burst of just pure speed, but, you know, 9, 10 hours is a long time. And so what I trained to do and thought would serve me well was to just go out and get 7 or 8 hours into a day and then go hard. And so I got good at that. And that's really what it came down to. We got to the 7 and 8 hour marks of that day, and Carlos figured that he'd already have me broken spirited and put away, and I kept kind of creeping back up on him. I caught him in the bike and then flatted, and he got away and probably thought he had me in the chair. But I had trained in a manner that was going to let me shine late in the race, and that's what it came down to.
I remember that, and I was out there on the road, and I remember when you came through town on the racing chair, and you were a few minutes back, maybe 5 minutes back, and it was your mom's birthday, and she and Gina were there in downtown on Ali'i Drive when you came through town. And I think at that point, the family was like, okay, we're resigned to the fact that, you know, there was a golf clap going on and good try, honey. And it was pretty much, you know, okay, this Carlos guy just is too strong, too tough, and it's over. But the other thing I remember is being out at the Energy Lab and watching you guys go into the Energy Lab. And the lead at that point was only a couple minutes. And
right.
I remember trying to get a hold of Rich Cruz, our photographer, who was shooting sunsets. I'm like, dude, you got to get back here. We're going to have a pass here soon. But during that week, you weren't planning to go into the Energy Lab in your training. That's a little 4 mile loop, and you know, there's a point of, am I going to overdo it in training? Should I save something for race day? But you went down there and did those 4 miles in training.
Yeah, there's a guy, I wish I could remember where he was from, really neat guy, and he was out on his bicycle. And when I pulled up to that spot, that's where I planned to go, just to Energy Lab and back. I thought, you know, this is pretty close to the race. I don't need to put a dent in my race with that. I know where it goes.
Yeah.
But I just felt like, you know, I want to, this is about the time of day and the light and the, you know, the roads wasn't perfect down there. It gets a little rough down there at that right-hander. And I just wanted I wanted to prove it to myself that I wanted it.
Yeah.
And I figured it might come down to that stretch of road, you know, where I could be getting close. And I just wanted to know it, just like a motocross track. I wanted to, you know, I spent extra time walking it and looking for different lines and stuff. And although it's just a road down there, it's on a motocross track, there's ways to figure out, okay, where do I need to really be on it? Where can I rest? What line can I take? And where are the bumps to look
right.
out for? And
yeah.
I'd flatted there once. So I just decided, yeah, I'm going to go down there and just visualize this thing. And I had it in my head that if, in fact, I was still in second and he was having a good day like he'd shown he was capable of, that I could put some doubt in his mind, you know, at the turnaround and be closing. And it played out almost exactly like I thought. And Rich Cruz, man, He captured the moment, you know. For me, Carlos wasn't in it, but by those big bougainvilleas out there, when you get out of the Energy Lab and head back to town, man, I had the eye of the tiger through there. And I'm not sure if that photo was as I was closing in, you know, just really feeling like, when should I pounce, or just after, but the look on my face at the CF building, it's a look of intensity and purpose, and Rich captured it. And so that stretch of road is special to me, and so is that photo, because it took me 3 years.
Right.
And a lot of disappointment, and a lot of trial and error, a lot of digging deep, finding out just how tough I was willing to be to, you know, be captured in that frame of mind. And going that fast, you know, to finally make Carlos just go, you can have it, you know, because he fought and fought and eventually just was out of gas, you know. It was a great race. If it weren't for him, I don't know that my Ironman experience, it would have been neat to do it, no, without a doubt, but it wouldn't be as special. I don't even know if we'd be talking now had it not been such a war similar to the ones that Mark and Dave had just on our division.
Well, and what was cool about it, from my perspective, obviously we worked hard to get a hand cycle division in that race, and watching those 3 years, basically the chair drifted away, the hand cycle drifted away. It was two athletes, right, who were in the Ironman trying to see who was best. And the disability became immaterial. It became two great athletes who wanted to kick the other guy's ass, right? That,
yep.
At the end of the day, that's what it was all about. So what I loved was when you're coming down Lead Drive and tears are flowing and you know you've got this thing won, you come across the line, really exciting, but you wanted to wait there for Carlos. And I thought that was really – it was really cool to see the sportsmanship, because I think you guys both realized – that you pushed each other to a level that neither of you probably would have reached on your own.
Yeah, with I don't know about that with Carlos, because he pushes as hard as he can go every time out. He's shown that over the years and still. But definitely he, I can say it, you know, because I know he pushed me further than I was willing to go early on, and then eventually just went, okay, well, you know, like you said, my mom and everyone giving me the golf clap, and you know, I could just, you know, as I passed, I wasn't sure at that point what I had, if I was going to be able to catch him. There were some doubts, but still a little bit of possibility, and I could just picture them thinking, oh man, you know, I'm going to be hard to live with, you know, after this three times, it's just not meant to be. The guy's just better. I don't like that. You know, I like to at least put up a closer fight and get something out of it out of 3 years. And so, you know, I have Carlos to thank for being that thing out there, that one other person in the world that wanted it, you know, the same thing I did. And it was a great battle. And, you know, thanks for letting me stay there. You know, it gets a little bit bogged up at the finish and everybody wanting to hang out and busy, and for allowing me to kind of hang out there off to the side and see Carlos finish. And it was neat to see him smiling still, like, hey, you know, he went fast that day, he fought hard. And it seems like at the time I wasn't completely sold on what he had said to me, as far as like, oh, I was happy for you. I'm like, nah, I don't know, I wasn't happy for you when you beat me. But in the years that have passed, he was, you know, he knew that that I had earned it.
Exactly.
And when I went back in 2009 and Jason Fowler pretty much put me away, almost in the same exact spot for the win, I was happy for Jason. So I kind of experienced what I had done to Carlos,
yeah,
that day, and I was truly happy to see somebody just, you know, actually do what they had to do to beat you, and sort of beat me. And so, yeah, it was Carlos and I, just like Rick Johnson and I in motocross, you know, we'll always get mentioned together, you know, when it comes to Ironman. And that's really neat that Ironman allowed us to even have that battle. There was a division that John McClain proved it, that you could do it. And, you know, 13 years after a honeymoon, and thinking, well, there goes that goal. You know, I'm injured in the chair. I guess I got to throw that out the window. The irony is, I might not have ever done Ironman had I not gotten hurt.
Right.
You know, I don't know if I'd have qualified. So, you know, real blessing that things panned out the way they did. It doesn't always look good, you know, sometimes, but it can turn into something great.
You know, when you talk full circle, we talk about you and Ironman, and you know, being there, watching it on your honeymoon, and then coming back and doing it 13 years later. You're working with a young motocross kid named, you know, Ricky James, who's really an up and comer, and then he gets paralyzed. And what are the odds on that? And then, so you know, as the somebody who was a motocross guy and had also gone through what you went through, parents obviously reached out to you. What was your message to his folks?
Pretty much just the same thing that Knob told me early on was, you know, don't sit around, don't mope about it, make it, turn it into a positive, focus on what you can do. And, you know, when Knob got that message to me, I already spent a couple of years, you know, of throwing a huge pity party that at one point got to the you know, so low. I didn't even want to live, Bob. I mean, you know, it's kind of embarrassing to say at this point, but I, you know, it's the truth. And I think there's a lot of people that get that way, whether injured or not. Life can just beat you down at times, and you're never really out from under that. And when you're in a chair, it's just way more obvious, and, you know, for a variety of reasons. And he didn't get to have his dream in motocross like I did. So that was one thing I was always sensitive to with him, and always trying to help him let go of. And, yeah, you know, it's like somebody's got a ton of money telling somebody that doesn't have any. Oh, it's money, you know, it's not going to make you happy. You're like, well, can I try that out myself?
I'll make that decision.
Who's going to be the judge of that?
Yeah, give me some money and I'll try it, yeah.
You know, there's probably a little bit of that with him regarding motocross, but I was just like, take that motivation and apply it to something that you can do. And so I was really glad that. I mean, he was a great student there in 08. You know, I had gone through some physical stuff, a pressure sore, and I was...
You were a mess.
Out of my shell. Oh, yeah.
You were down to, what, 120 pounds? You'd been face down in a pillow for 9 months or so, if not longer. And, you know, sort of, to me, it was a little cathartic for you to be able to where, like, it worked both ways. You were helping Ricky learn the whole triathlon thing, but Ricky was also getting you outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And if he wouldn't have accepted the challenge to take on Ironman, and because, you know, I mean, I know since 08 that he wasn't really into it, but he had enough respect and he knew he needed to do something. And you could tell that his parents were cheerleading the thing and, you know, the whole Ironman possibility. And, you know, if he hadn't been a good student, then the whole thing would have just fizzled. I don't know what I would. I might not have gone back in 09 and done another one, or dug out of the hole that I was in physically and got back to the point I'm at now, where I feel like I might want to do another one.
Exactly.
So I'm grateful that he listened. He didn't argue with me. As soon as he finished 08 and did well, and I went back over and did mine, and he went off and did truck racing and things.
Yep.
And now he'll question me a little bit more because he's done more Ironmans than I have now. He's doing Louisville today.
I know, and so, he's doing Kona in a few weeks.
Yeah, so he's, you know, he's not necessarily just a student. You know, he's faster than me. So he asks more questions. But back in 08, it was a special time because he needed something. I needed something. And, you know, it helped the both of us. And I don't know if I helped Kanab at all, but maybe. Maybe I was somebody to train with, somebody that was fun for him to share all his knowledge with, and somebody to go to Boston with and room with. And maybe he did just a little bit more. I don't know. But for sure it was that way with Ricky, because as I was riding with him, you know, he's looking at me like, man, you know, you're still pretty strong. Why don't you do Ironman again? I'm like, oh, I've already, you know, how could I top what happened in, you know, 98, 99, and 2000? That was third, second, first, you know, end of story. But the story's not over. There's always something you can add to it, another chapter. And Ricky was that was a fun thing in 08. And, you know, I watched him come out of the swim in like 117 and finish. And, you know, I was choked up.
Yeah.
Watching where he was in his head and all that, to in surgery on his shoulder in just 10 months. I felt as pretty close, in a little different way, but as satisfied and happy about the outcome for him as I was for myself when I did the race. So I, you know, that's when I realized, you know, kind of what Jim was talking about and what my friend Todd, who had done the Ironman years before as a pro, had shared with me. You know, it's helping others and getting the best out of yourself and learning how to teach and pass that down. That's the real gift. And, you know, there's a chance somewhere in the future. I think my competitive days are, you know, I'm up there, 52. But I don't suppose it's out of the question if think that Ricky and I would be in the same Ironman one of these days.
How cool that would that happen. Be? That could totally
be funny, you know?
Hey, David, thanks so much for taking so much time. So much. It's always so much fun to talk to you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you reaching out and bringing me on. I always love to share that story, and I don't think it's over. You know?
No. Just beginning, buddy. Just beginning.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yep.
All right.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Always a pleasure. David Bailey has been our guest on Babbittville. We are brought to you by Kale1020.com, by CoreSports.com. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.